We must also insist on the extension of this right in practice to all classes of citizens. 114. As our predecessor Pius XII so rightly affirmed, the dignity of the human person normally demands the right to the use of the goods of the earth, to which corresponds the fundamental obligation of granting an opportunity to possess property to all if possible. 33. This demand arises from the moral dignity of work. It also guarantees the conservation and perfection of a social order which makes possible a secure, even if modest, property to all classes of people. 34. 115. Now, if ever, is the time to insist on a more widespread distribution of property, in view of the rapid economic development of an increasing number of states. It will not be difficult for the body politic, by the adoption of various techniques of proved efficiency, to pursue an economic and social policy which facilitates the widest possible distribution of private property in terms of durable consumer goods, houses, land, tools, and equipment in the case of craftsmen and owners of family farms, and shares in medium and large business concerns. This policy is in fact being pursued with considerable success by several of the socially and economically advanced nations. 116. This, of course, is not to deny the lawfulness of state and public ownership of productive goods, especially those which carry with them a power too great to be left to private individuals without injury to the community at large. 35. 117. State and public ownership of property is very much on the increase today. This is explained by the exigencies of the common good, which demand that public authority broaden its sphere of activity. But here too, the principle of subsidiary function must be observed. The state and other agencies of public law must not extend their ownership beyond what is clearly required by considerations of the common good properly understood, and even then there must be safeguards. Otherwise private ownership could be reduced beyond measure, or, even worse, completely destroyed. 118. It is important too, not to overlook the fact that the economic enterprises of the state and other agencies of public law must be entrusted to men of good reputation who have the necessary experience and ability and a keen sense of responsibility toward their country. Furthermore, a strict check should constantly be kept upon their activity, so as to avoid any possibility of the concentration of undue economic power in the hands of a few state officials, to the detriment of the best interests of the community. 119. Our predecessors have insisted rhyme and again on the social function inherent in the right of private ownership, for it cannot be denied that in the plan of the Creator all of this world's goods are primarily intended for the worthy support of the entire human race. Hence, as Leo XIII so wisely taught in Rerum Novarum, whoever has received from the divine bounty a large share of temporal blessings, whether they be external and corporeal, or gifts of the mind, has received them for the purpose of using them for the perfecting of his own nature, and, at the same time, that he may employ them, as the steward of God's providence, for the benefit of others. He that hath a talent, says Saint Gregory the Great, let him see that he hide it not. He that hath abundance, let him quicken himself to mercy and to generosity. He that hath art and skill, let him do his best to share the use and the utility thereof with his neighbor. 36. 120. In recent years the state and other agencies of public law have extended, and are continuing to extend, the sphere of their activity and initiative. But this does not mean that the doctrine of the social function of private ownership is out of date, as some would maintain. It is inherent in the very right of private ownership. Then too, a further consideration arises. Tragic situations and urgent problems of an intimate and personal nature are continually arising which the state with all its machinery is unable to remedy or assist. There will always remain, therefore, a vast field for the exercise of human sympathy and the Christian charity of individuals. We would observe, finally, that the efforts of individuals, or of groups of private citizens, are definitely more effective in promoting spiritual values than is the activity of public authority. 121. We should notice at this point that the right of private ownership is clearly sanctioned by the gospel. Yet at the same time, The Divine Master frequently extends to the rich the insistent invitation to convert their material goods into spiritual ones, by conferring them on the poor. Lay not up to yourselves treasures on earth, where the rust and moth consume, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up to yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither the rust nor moth doth consume, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. 37. And the Lord will look upon the charity given to the poor as given to himself. Amen, I say to you, as long as you did it to one of these my least brethren, you did it to me. 38. 122. History shows with ever-increasing clarity that it is not only the relations between workers and managers that need to be re-established on the basis of justice and equity, but also those between the various branches of the economy, between areas of varying productivity within the same political community, and between countries with a different degree of social and economic development. 123. First, with regard to agriculture, it would not appear that the rural population as a whole is decreasing, but it is an undeniable fact that many people are moving away from their farms into more thickly populated areas as well as into the cities themselves. When we realize that this movement of population is going on in nearly every part of the world, often on a large scale, we begin to appreciate the complexity of the human problems involved, and their difficulty of solution. 124. We know that as an economy develops, the number of people engaged in agriculture decreases, while the percentage employed in industry and the various services rises. Nevertheless, we believe that very often this movement of population from farming to industry has other causes besides those dependent upon economic expansion. Among these there is the desire to escape from confining surroundings which offer little prospect of a more comfortable way of life. There is the lure of novelty and adventure which has taken such a hold on the present generation, the attractive prospect of easy money or greater freedom and the enjoyment of all the amenities of town and city life. But a contributory cause of this movement away from the country is doubtless the fact that farming has become a depressed occupation. It is inadequate both in productive efficiency and in the standard of living it provides. 125. Nearly every country, therefore, is faced with this fundamental problem. What can be done to reduce the disproportion in productive efficiency between agriculture on the one hand, and industry and services on the other, and to ensure that agricultural living standards approximate as closely as possible those enjoyed by city dwellers who draw their resources either from industry or from the services in which they are engaged? What can be done to persuade agricultural workers that, far from being inferior to other people, they have every opportunity of developing their personality through their work, and can look forward to the future with confidence? 126. It seems to us opportune to indicate certain directives that can contribute to a solution of this problem, directives which we believe have value whatever may be the historical environment in which one acts, on condition, obviously, that they be applied in the manner and to the degree allowed, suggested, or even demanded by the circumstances. 127. In the first place, considerable thought must be given, especially by public authorities, to the suitable development of essential facilities in country areas, such as roads, transportation, means of communication, drinking water, housing, health services, elementary, technical and professional education, religious and recreational facilities, and the supply of modern installations and furnishings for the farm residents. Such services as these are necessary nowadays, if a becoming standard of living is to be maintained. In those country areas where they are lacking, economic and social progress is either prevented or greatly impeded, with the result that nothing can be done to retard the drift of population away from the land, and it even becomes difficult to make a good appraisal of the numbers involved. 128. If a country is to develop economically, it must do so gradually, maintaining an even balance between all sectors of the economy. Agriculture, therefore, must be allowed to make use of the same reforms in the method and type of production, and in the conduct of the business side of the venture as are permitted or required in the economic system as a whole. All such reforms should correspond as nearly as possible with those introduced in industry and the various services. 129. In this way, agriculture will absorb a larger amount of industrial goods, and require a better system of services. But at the same time it will provide both industry and the services and the country as a whole with the type of products which, in quantity and quality, best meet the needs of the consumer, and contribute to the stability of the purchasing power of money, a major consideration in the orderly development of the entire economic system. 130. One advantage which would result from the adoption of this plan would be that it would be easier to keep track of the movement of the working force set free by the progressive modernization of agriculture. Facilities could then be provided for the training of such people for their new kind of work, and they would not be left without economic aid and the mental and spiritual assistance they need to ensure their proper integration in their new social milieu. 131. In addition, a sound agricultural program is needed if public authority is to maintain an evenly balanced progress in the various branches of the economy. This must take into account tax policies, credit, social insurance, prices, the fostering of ancillary industries and the adjustment of the structure of farming as a business enterprise. 132. In a system of taxation based on justice and equity, it is fundamental that the burdens be proportioned to the capacity of the people contributing. 133. But the common good also requires the public authorities, in assessing the amount of tax payable, take cognizance of the peculiar difficulties of farmers. They have to wait longer than most people for their returns, and these are exposed to greater hazards. Consequently, farmers find greater difficulty in obtaining the capital necessary to increase returns. 134. For this reason too, investors are more inclined to put their money in industry rather than agriculture. Farmers are unable to pay high rates of interest. Indeed, they cannot as a rule make the trading profit necessary to furnish capital for the conduct and development of their own business. It is therefore necessary, for reasons of the common good, for public authorities to evolve a special credit policy and to form credit banks which will guarantee such capital to farmers at a moderate rate of interest. 135. In agriculture, the existence of two forms of insurance may be necessary, one concerned with agricultural produce, the other with the farm workers and their families. We realize that agricultural workers earn less per capita than workers in industry and the services, but that is no reason why it should be considered socially just and equitable to set up systems of social insurance in which the allowances granted to farm workers and their families are substantially lower than those payable to other classes of workers. Insurance programs that are established for the general public should not differ markedly whatever be the economic sector in which the individuals work or the source of their income. 136. Systems of social insurance and social security can make a most effective contribution to the overall distribution of national income in accordance with the principles of justice and equity. They can therefore be instrumental in reducing imbalances between the different classes of citizens. 137. Given the special nature of agricultural produce, modern economists must devise a suitable means of price protection. Ideally, such price protection should be enforced by the interested parties themselves, though supervision by the public authority cannot be altogether dispensed with. 138. On this subject it must not be forgotten that the price of agricultural produce represents, for the most part, the reward of the farmer's labor, rather than a return on invested capital. 139. Hence, in Quadragesimo Anno Pope Pius XI rightly observed that a proper proportion between different wages is also a matter of importance, he continued, and intimately connected with this is a proper proportion between the prices charged for the products of the various economic groups, agricultural, industrial, and so forth. 39. 140. While it is true that farm produce is mainly intended for the satisfaction of man's primary needs, and the price should therefore be within the means of all consumers. This cannot be used as an argument for keeping a section of the population, farm workers, in a permanent state of economic and social inferiority, depriving them of the wherewithal for a decent standard of living. This would be diametrically opposed to the common good. 141. Moreover, the time has come to promote in agricultural regions the establishment of those industries and services which are concerned with the preservation, processing, and transportation of farm products. Enterprises relating to other sectors of the economy might also be established there. In this case, the rural population would have another means of income at their disposal, a means which they could exploit in the social milieu to which they are accustomed. 142. It is not possible to determine a priori what the structure of farm life should be, since rural conditions vary so much from place to place, and from country to country throughout the world. But if we hold to a human and Christian concept of man and the family, we are bound to consider as an ideal that form of enterprise which is modeled on the basis of a community of persons working together for the advancement of their mutual interests in accordance with the principles of justice and Christian teaching. We are bound above all to consider as an ideal the kind of farm which is owned and managed by the family. Every effort must be made in the prevailing circumstances to give effective encouragement to farming enterprises of this nature. 143. But if the family farm is not to go bankrupt, it must make enough money to keep the family in reasonable comfort. To ensure this, farmers must be given up-to-date instruction on the latest methods of cultivation, and the assistance of experts must be put at their disposal. They should also form a flourishing system of cooperative undertakings, and organize themselves professionally, to take an effective part in public life, both on the administrative and the political level. 144. We are convinced that the farming community must take an active part in its own economic advancement, social progress and cultural betterment. Those who live on the land can hardly fail to appreciate the nobility of the work they are called upon to do. They are living in close harmony with nature, the majestic temple of creation. Their work has to do with the life of plants and animals, a life that is inexhaustible in its expression, inflexible in its laws, rich in allusions to God the Creator and Provider. They produce food for the support of human life, and the raw materials of industry in ever richer supply. 145. Theirs is a work which carries with it a dignity all its own. It brings into its service many branches of engineering, chemistry and biology, and is itself a cause of the continued practical development of these sciences in view of the repercussions of scientific and technical progress on the business of farming. It is a work which demands a capacity for orientation and adaptation, patient waiting, a sense of responsibility, and a spirit of perseverance and enterprise. 146. It is important also to bear in mind that in agriculture, as in other sectors of production, association is a vital need today, especially in the case of family farms. Rural workers should feel a sense of solidarity with one another, and should unite to form cooperatives and professional associations. These are very necessary if farm workers are to benefit from scientific and technical methods of production, and protect the prices of their products. They are necessary too, if they are to attain an equal footing with other professional classes who, in most cases, have joined together in associations. They are necessary, finally, if farm workers are to have their proper voice in political circles, and in public administration. The lone voice is not likely to command much of a hearing in times such as ours. 147. In using their various organizations, agricultural workers, as indeed all other classes of workers, must always be guided by moral principles and respect for the civil law. They must try to reconcile their rights and interests with those of other classes of workers, and even subordinate the one to the other, if the common good demands it. If they show themselves alive to the common good, and contribute to its realizations, they can legitimately demand that their efforts for the improvement of agricultural conditions be seconded and complemented by public authority. 148. We therefore desire here to express our satisfaction with those sons of ours the world over who are actively engaged in cooperatives, in professional groups, and in worker movements intent on raising the economic and social standards of the agricultural community. 149. In the work on the farm, the human personality finds every incentive for self-expression, self-development and spiritual growth. It is a work, therefore, which should be thought of as a vocation, a God-given mission, an answer to God's call to actuate His providential, saving plan in history. It should be thought of, finally, as a noble task, undertaken with a view to raising oneself and others to a higher degree of civilization. 150. Among citizens of the same political community there is often a marked degree of economic and social inequality. The main reason for this is the fact that they are living and working in different areas, some of which are more economically developed than others. Where this situation obtains, justice and equity demand that public authority try to eliminate or reduce such imbalances. It should ensure that the less developed areas receive such essential public services as their circumstances require, in order to bring the standard of living in these areas into line with the national average. Furthermore, a suitable economic and social policy must be devised which will take into account the supply of labor, the drift of population, wages, taxes, credit, and the investing of money, especially in expanding industries. In short, it should be a policy designed to promote useful employment, enterprising initiative, and the exploitation of local resources. 151. But the justification of all government action is the common good. Public authority, therefore, must bear in mind the interests of the state as a whole, which means that it must promote all three areas of production, agriculture, industry and services, simultaneously and evenly. Everything must be done to ensure that citizens of the less developed areas are treated as responsible human beings, and are allowed to play a major role in achieving their own economic, social, and cultural advancement. 152. Private enterprise too must contribute to an economic and social balance in the different areas of the same political community. Indeed, in accordance with the principle of subsidiary function, public authority must encourage and assist private enterprise, entrusting to it, wherever possible, the continuation of economic development. 153. It is not out of place to remark here on a problem which exists in quite a number of countries, namely, a gross disproportion between land and population. In some countries arable land abounds, but there is a scarcity of population, whereas in other countries the position is reversed, the population is large, arable land scarce. 154. Again, some countries use primitive methods of agriculture, with the result that, for all their abundance of natural resources, they are not able to produce enough food to feed their population, whereas other countries, using modern methods of agriculture, produce a surplus of food which has an adverse effect on the economy. 155. It is therefore obvious that the solidarity of the human race and Christian brotherhood demand the elimination as far as possible of these discrepancies. With this object in view, people all over the world must cooperate actively with one another in all sorts of ways, so as to facilitate the movement of goods, capital and men from one country to another. We shall have more to say on this point later on. 156. Here we would like to express our sincere appreciation of the work which the FAO has undertaken to establish effective collaboration among nations, to promote the modernization of agriculture, especially in less developed countries, and to alleviate the suffering of hunger-stricken peoples. 157. Probably the most difficult problem today concerns the relationship between political communities that are economically advanced and those in the process of development. Whereas the standard of living is high in the former, the latter are subject to extreme poverty. The solidarity which binds all men together as members of a common family makes it impossible for wealthy nations to look with indifference upon the hunger, misery, and poverty of other nations whose citizens are unable to enjoy even elementary human rights. The nations of the world are becoming more and more dependent on one another, and it will not be possible to preserve a lasting peace so long as glaring economic and social imbalances persist. 158. Mindful of our position as the father of all peoples, we feel constrained to repeat here what we said on another occasion: we are all equally responsible for the undernourished people. 40. Hence, it is necessary to educate one's conscience to the sense of responsibility which weighs upon each and every one, especially upon those who are more blessed with this world's goods. 41. 159. The Church has always emphasized that this obligation of helping those who are in misery and want should be felt most strongly by Catholics, in view of the fact that they are members of the mystical body of Christ. In this we have known the charity of God, says Saint John, because he has laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. He that hath the substance of this world, and shall see his brother in need, and shall shut up his bowels from him, how doth the charity of God abide in him? 42. 160. It is therefore a great source of joy to us to see those nations which enjoy a high degree of economic wealth helping the nations not so well provided, so that they may more effectively raise their standard of living. 161. Justice and humanity demand that those countries which produce consumer goods, especially farm products, in excess of their own needs should come to the assistance of those other countries where large sections of the population are suffering from want and hunger. It is nothing less than an outrage to justice and humanity to destroy or to squander goods that other people need for their very lives. 162. We are, of course, well aware that overproduction, especially in agriculture, can cause economic harm to a certain section of the population. But it does not follow that one is thereby exonerated from extending emergency aid to those who need it. On the contrary, everything must be done to minimize the ill effects of overproduction, and to spread the burden equitably over the entire population. 163. Of itself, however, emergency aid will not go far in relieving want and famine when these are caused, as they so often are, by the primitive state of a nation's economy. The only permanent remedy for this is to make use of every possible means of providing these citizens with the scientific, technical, and professional training they need, and to put at their disposal the necessary capital for speeding up their economic development with the help of modern methods. 164. We are aware how deeply the public conscience has been affected in recent years by the urgent need of supporting the economic development and social progress of those countries which are still struggling against poverty and economic disabilities. 165. International and regional organizations, national and private societies, all are working towards this goal, increasing day to day the measure of their own technical cooperation in all productive spheres. By their combined efforts, thousands of young people are being given facilities for attending the universities of the more advanced countries, and acquiring an up-to-date scientific, technical, and professional training. World banking institutes, individual states and private persons are helping to furnish the capital for an ever-richer network of economic enterprises in the less wealthy countries. It is a magnificent work that they are doing, and we are most happy to take this occasion of giving it the praise that it deserves. It is a work, however, which needs to be increased, and we hope that the years ahead will see the wealthier nations making even greater efforts for the scientific, technical, and economic advancement of those political communities whose development is still only in its initial stages. 166. We consider it our duty to give further advice on this matter. 167. In the first place, those nations which are still only at the beginning of their journey along the road to economic development would do well to consider carefully the experiences of the wealthier nations which have traversed this road before them. 168. Increase in production and productive efficiency is, of course, sound policy, and indeed a vital necessity. However, it is no less necessary, and justice itself demands, that the riches produced be distributed fairly among all members of the political community. This means that everything must be done to ensure that social progress keeps pace with economic progress. Again, every sector of the economy agriculture, industry and the services, must progress evenly and simultaneously. 169. The developing nations, obviously, have certain unmistakable characteristics of their own, resulting from the nature of the particular region and the natural dispositions of their citizens, with their time-honored traditions and customs. 170. In helping these nations, therefore, the more advanced communities must recognize and respect this individuality. They must beware of making the assistance they give an excuse for forcing these people into their own national mold. 171. There is also a further temptation which the economically developed nations must resist, that of giving technical and financial aid with the view to gaining control over the political situation in the poorer countries, and furthering their own plans for world domination. 172. Let us be quite clear on this point. A nation that acted from these motives would in fact be introducing a new form of colonialism, cleverly disguised, no doubt, but actually reflecting that older outdated type from which many nations have recently emerged. Such action would, moreover, have harmful impact on international relations, and constitute a menace to world peace. 173. Necessity, therefore, and justice demand, that all such technical and financial aid be given without thought of domination, but rather for the purpose of helping the less developed nations to achieve their own economic and social growth. 174. If this can be achieved, then a precious contribution will have been made to the formation of a world community, in which each individual nation, conscious of its rights and duties, can work on terms of equality with the rest for the attainment of universal prosperity. 175. Scientific and technical progress, economic development and the betterment of living conditions, are certainly valuable elements in a civilization. But we must realize that they are essentially instrumental in character. They are not supreme values in themselves. 176. It pains us, therefore, to observe the complete indifference to the true hierarchy of values shown by so many people in the economically developed countries. Spiritual values are ignored, forgotten, or denied, while the progress of science, technology, and economics is pursued for its own sake, as though material well-being were the be-all and end-all of life. This attitude is contagious, especially when it infects the work that is being done for the less developed countries, which have often preserved in their ancient traditions an acute and vital awareness of the more important human values on which the moral order rests. 177. To attempt to undermine this national integrity is clearly immoral. It must be respected, and as far as possible clarified and developed, so that it may remain what it is, a foundation of true civilization. 178. The Church is by divine right universal. History itself bears this out, for the Church is present everywhere on earth, doing all that she can to embrace all peoples. 179. Now, in bringing people to Christ, the Church has invariably, both now and in the past, brought them many social and economical advantages. For true Christians cannot help feeling obliged to improve their own temporal institutions and environment. They do all they can to prevent these institutions from doing violence to human dignity. They encourage whatever is conducive to honesty and virtue, and strive to eliminate every obstacle to the attainment of this aim. 180. Moreover, in becoming as it were the lifeblood of these people, the Church is not, nor does she consider herself to be, a foreign body in their midst. Her presence brings about the rebirth, the resurrection, of each individual in Christ, and the man who is reborn and rises again in Christ never feels himself constrained from without. He feels himself free in the very depth of his being, and freely raised up to God. And thus he affirms and develops that side of his nature which is noblest and best. 181. The Church of Jesus Christ, as our predecessor Pius XII observed with such penetration, is the repository of his wisdom. She is certainly too wise to discourage or belittle those peculiarities and differences which mark out one nation from another. It is quite legitimate for nations to treat those differences as a sacred inheritance and guard them at all costs. The Church aims at unity, a unity determined and kept alive by that supernatural love which should be actuating everybody. She does not aim at a uniformity which would only be external in its effects, and would cramp the natural tendencies of the nations concerned. Every nation has its own genius, its own qualities, springing from the hidden roots of its being. The wise development, the encouragement within limits, of that genius, those qualities, does no harm, and if a nation cares to take precautions, to lay down rules, for that end, it is the Church's approval. She is mother enough to befriend such projects with her prayers, provided that they are not opposed to the duties incumbent on men from their common origin, and share destiny. 43.182. It is a source of profound satisfaction to us to see the prominent part which is being played by Catholic citizens of the less wealthy countries in the economic and social development of their own state. 183. Then too, the Catholics of the wealthier states are doing all they can to increase the effectiveness of the social and economic work that is being done for the poorer nations. We would give our special approval to the increasing assistance they are giving, in all sorts of ways, to African and Asian students scattered throughout the universities of Europe and America, and to the care that is being devoted to the training of those persons who are prepared to go to the less wealthy areas, in order to engage in work of technical and professional nature. 184. To these our beloved sons in every land who, in promoting genuine progress in civilization, are a living proof of the Church's perennial vitality, we wish to extend our kind and fatherly word of appreciation and encouragement. 185. How can economic development and the supply of food keep pace with the continual rise in population? This is a question which constantly obtrudes itself today, a world problem, as well as one for the poverty-stricken nations. 186. As a world problem, the case is put thus. According to sufficiently reliable statistics, the next few decades will see a very great increase in human population, whereas economic development will proceed at a slower rate. Hence, we are told, if nothing is done to check this rise in population, the world will be faced in the not-too-distant future with an increasing shortage in the necessities of life. 187. As it affects the less developed countries, the problem is stated thus. The resources of modern hygiene and medicine will very shortly bring about a notable decrease in the mortality rate, especially among infants, while the birth rate, which in such countries is unusually high, will tend to remain more or less constant, at least for a considerable period. The excess of births over deaths will therefore show a steep rise, whereas there will be no corresponding increase in the productive efficiency of the economy. Accordingly, the standard of living in these poorer countries cannot possibly improve. It must surely worsen, even to the point of extreme hardship. Hence there are those who hold the opinion that, in order to prevent a serious crisis from developing, the conception and birth of children should be secretly avoided, or, in any event, curbed in some way. 188. Truth to tell, we do not seem to be faced with any immediate or imminent world problem arising from the disproportion between the increase of population and the supply of food. Arguments to this effect are based on such unreliable and controversial data that they can only be of very uncertain validity. 189. Besides, the resources which God in His goodness and wisdom has implanted in nature are well nigh inexhaustible, and He has at the same time given man the intelligence to discover ways and means of exploiting these resources for his own advantage and his own livelihood. Hence, the real solution of the problem is not to be found in expedients which offend against the divinely established moral order, and which attack human life at its very source, but in a renewed scientific and technical effort on man's part to deepen and extend his dominion over nature. The progress of science and technology that has already been achieved opens up almost limitless horizons in this field. 190. As for the problems which face the poorer nations in various parts of the world, we realize, of course, that these are very real. They are caused, more often than not, by a deficient economic and social organization, which does not offer living conditions proportionate to the increase in population. They are caused, also, by the lack of effective solidarity among such peoples. 191. But granting this, We must nevertheless state most emphatically that no statement of the problem, and no solution to it is acceptable which does violence to man's essential dignity. Those who propose such solutions base them on an utterly materialistic conception of man himself and his life. 192. The only possible solution to this question is one which envisages the social and economic progress both of individuals and of the whole of human society, and which respects and promotes true human values. First consideration must obviously be given to those values which concern man's dignity generally, and the immense worth of each individual human life. Attention must then be turned to the need for worldwide cooperation among men, with a view to a fruitful and well-regulated interchange of useful knowledge, capital and manpower. 193. We must solemnly proclaim that human life is transmitted by means of the family, and the family is based upon a marriage, which is one and indissoluble, and, with respect to Christians, raised to the dignity of a sacrament. The transmission of human life is the result of a personal and conscious act, and, as such, is subject to the all's holy, inviolable and immutable laws of God, which no man may ignore or disobey. He is not therefore permitted to use certain ways and means which are allowable in the propagation of plant and animal life. 194. Human life is sacred. All men must recognize that fact. From its very inception it reveals the creating hand of God. Those who violate His laws not only offend the divine majesty, and degrade themselves and humanity, they also sap the vitality of the political community of which they are members. 195. It is of the utmost importance that parents exercise their right and obligation toward the younger generation by securing for their children a sound cultural and religious formation. They must also educate them to a deep sense of responsibility in life, especially in such matters as concern the foundation of a family and the procreation and education of children. They must instill in them an unshakable confidence in divine providence and a determination to accept the inescapable sacrifices and hardships involved in so noble and important a task as the cooperation with God in the transmitting of human life and the bringing up of children. To the attainment of this end, nothing can be more effective than those principles and that supernatural aid which the Church supplies. On this score alone, the right of the Church to full liberty in the exercise of her mission must be recognized. 196. Genesis relates how God gave two commandments to our first parents, to transmit human life, increase and multiply 44, and to bring nature into their service, fill the earth, and subdue it 45. These two commandments are complementary. 197. Nothing is said in the second of these commandments about destroying nature. On the contrary, it must be brought into the service of human life. 198. We are sick at heart, therefore, when we observe the contradiction which has beguiled so much modern thinking. On the one hand we are shown the fearful specter of want and misery which threatens to extinguish human life, and on the other hand we find scientific discoveries, technical inventions and economic resources being used to provide terrible instruments of ruin and death. 199. A provident God grants sufficient means to the human race to find a dignified solution to the problems attendant upon the transmission of human life. But these problems can become difficult of solution, or even insoluble, if man, led astray in mind, and perverted in will, turns to such means as are opposed to right reason, and seeks ends that are contrary to his social nature and the intentions of Providence. 200. The progress of science and technology in every aspect of life has led, particularly today, increased relationships between nations and made the nations more and more dependent on one another. 201. As a rule, no single commonwealth has sufficient resources at its command to solve the more important scientific, technical, economic, social, political and cultural problems which confront it at the present time. These problems are necessarily the concern of a whole group of nations, and possibly of the whole world. 202. Individual political communities may indeed enjoy a high degree of culture and civilization. They may have a large and industrious population, an advanced economic structure, great natural resources and extensive territories. Yet, Even so, in isolation from the rest of the world, they are quite incapable of finding an adequate solution to their major problems. The nations, therefore, must work with each other for their mutual development and perfection. They can help themselves only in so far as they succeed in helping one another. That is why international understanding and cooperation are so necessary. 203. Yet although individuals and nations are becoming more and more convinced of this twofold necessity, it would seem that men in general, and particularly those with high responsibility in public life, are showing themselves quite incapable of achieving it. The root of such inability is not to be sought in scientific, technical, or economic reasons, but in the absence of mutual trust. Men, and consequently states, are in mortal fear of each other. Each fears that the other harbors plans of conquest, and is only waiting for a favorable moment to put these plans into effect. Hence each organizes its own defense and builds up munitions of war as a deterrent against the would-be aggressor. 204. The result is a vast expenditure of human energy and natural resources on projects which are disruptive of human society, rather than beneficial to it, while a growing uneasiness gnaws at men's hearts and makes them less responsive to the call of nobler enterprises. 205. The root cause of so much mistrust is the presence of ideological differences between nations, and more especially between their rulers. There are some indeed who go so far as to deny the existence of a moral order which is transcendent, absolute, universal and equally binding upon all. And where the same law of justice is not adhered to by all, men cannot hope to come to open and full agreement on vital issues. 206. Yes, both sides speak of justice and the demands of justice, but these words frequently take on different or opposite meanings according to which side uses them. Hence, when rulers of nations appeal to justice and the demands of justice, they not only disagree on terms, but often increase the tension that exists between their states. And so the belief is engendered that, if a nation is to assert its rights and pursue its own interests, there is only one way open to it: to have recourse to violence, ignoring the fact that violence is the source of the very greatest evils. 207. Mutual trust among rulers of states cannot begin nor increase except by recognition of and respect for the moral order. 208. But the moral order has no existence except in God. Cut off from God, it must necessarily disintegrate. Moreover, man is not just a material organism. He consists also of spirit. He is endowed with reason and freedom. He demands, therefore, a moral and religious order, and it is this order, and not considerations of a purely extraneous material order, which has the greatest validity in the solution of problems relating to his life as an individual and as a member of society, and problems concerning individual states and their interrelations. 209. It has been claimed that in an era of scientific and technical triumphs such as ours, man can well afford to rely on his own powers and construct a very good civilization without God. But the truth is that these very advances in science and technology frequently involved the whole human race in such difficulties as can only be solved in the light of a sincere faith in God, the creator and ruler of man and his world. 210. The almost limitless horizons opened up by scientific research only go to confirm this truth. More and more men are beginning to realize that science has so far done little more than scratch the surface of nature and reality. There are vast hidden depths still to be explored and adequately explained. Such men are appalled when they consider how these gigantic forces for good can be turned by science into engines of destruction. They realize then the supreme importance of spiritual and moral values, if scientific and technical progress is to be used in the service of civilization, and not involve the whole human race in irremediable disaster. 211. Furthermore, the increasing sense of dissatisfaction with worldly goods, which is making itself felt among citizens of the wealthier nations, is rapidly destroying the treasured illusion of an earthly paradise. Men too are becoming more and more conscious of their rights as human beings, rights which are universal and inviolable, and they are aspiring to more just and more human relations with their fellows. The effect of all this is to make the modern man more deeply aware of his own limitations, and to create in him a striving for spiritual values. All of which encourages us in the hope that individuals and nations will one day learn to unite in a spirit of sincere understanding and profitable cooperation. 212. After all this scientific and technical progress, and even because of it, the problem remains, how to build up a new order of society, based on a more balanced human relationship between political communities on a national and international level. 213. The attempt to find a solution to this problem has given birth to a number of theories. Some of these were little more than ephemeral, others have undergone, and are still undergoing, substantial change, others again are proving themselves less and less attractive to modern man. Why is this? It is because these ideologies do not take account of the whole man, nor even of his most important part. In particular, they take little account of certain inevitable human weaknesses such as sickness and suffering, weaknesses which even the most advanced economic and social systems cannot completely eliminate. Finally, they fail to take account of that deep-rooted sense of religion which exists in all men everywhere, and which nothing, neither violence nor cunning, can eradicate. 214. The most fundamental modern error is that of imagining that man's natural sense of religion is nothing more than the outcome of feeling or fantasy. To be eradicated from his soul is an anachronism and an obstacle to human progress. And yet this very need for religion reveals a man for what he is, a being created by God, and tending always toward God. As we read in Saint Augustine, "Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts can find no rest until they rest in you." 46. 215. Let men make all the technical and economic progress they can, there will be no peace nor justice in the world until they return to a sense of their dignity as creatures and sons of God, who is the first and final cause of all created being. Separated from God, a man is but a monster, in himself and toward others, for the right ordering of human society presupposes the right ordering of man's conscience with God, who is himself the source of all justice, truth and love. 216. Here is a spectacle for all the world to see, thousands of our sons and brothers, whom we love so dearly, suffering years of bitter persecution in many lands, even those of an ancient Christian culture. And will not men who see clearly, and compare the superior dignity of the persecuted with that refined barbarity of their oppressors, soon return to their senses, if indeed they have not already done so? 217. The most perniciously typical aspect of the modern era consists in the absurd attempt to reconstruct a solid and fruitful temporal order divorced from God, who is, in fact, the only foundation on which it can endure. In seeking to enhance man's greatness, men fondly imagine that they can do so by drying up the source from which that greatness springs, and from which it is nourished. They want, that is, to restrain, and, if possible, to eliminate the soul's upward surge toward God. But today's experience of so much disillusionment and bloodshed only goes to confirm those words of Scripture, "Unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." 47. 218. The permanent validity of the Catholic Church's social teaching admits of no doubt. 219. This teaching rests on one basic principle: individual human beings are the foundation, the cause and the end of every social institution. That is necessarily so, for men are by nature social beings. This fact must be recognized, as also the fact that they are raised in the plan of providence to an order of reality which is above nature. 220. On this basic principle, which guarantees the sacred dignity of the individual, the Church constructs her social teaching. She has formulated, particularly over the past 100 years, and through the efforts of a very well-informed body of priests and laymen, a social doctrine which points out with clarity the sure way to social reconstruction. The principles she gives are of universal application, for they take human nature into account, and the varying conditions in which man's life is lived. They also take into account the principal characteristics of contemporary society, and are thus acceptable to all. 221. But today, more than ever, it is essential that this doctrine be known, assimilated, and put into effect in the form and manner that the different situations allow and demand. It is a difficult task indeed, yet a most noble one. To the performance of it we call not only our own sons and brothers scattered throughout the world, but also men of goodwill everywhere. 222. First, we must reaffirm most strongly that this Catholic social doctrine is an integral part of the Christian conception of life. 223. It is therefore our urgent desire that this doctrine be studied more and more.